August in Tucson means that college is back in session. And that means it's time for college football again. And that means tailgating. And you know what that means. That, no, not lukewarm hot dogs. No, well, yeah, Lee Corso's college game day mascot heads, but that's not what I meant. It's, no, it alcohol. It means alcohol, okay? Alcohol. So, we here at AZMcast figured we would lean into that scene and cover a topic that's sure to be all the rage this fall. Alcohol and alcohol withdrawal. So listen in as Brian, Chris, and I discuss the comatose, the tremulous, and everyone in between. Hi, everybody. So it's August, and we are going to be talking about something that pertains to college students who may be ramping up to this disease. Our students are coming back in Tucson, and we're going to talk about alcohol withdrawal. Yeah. So everyone loves a good alcohol withdrawal because you take a patient that's already shaky and tremulous and you're worried about their mental status, and you do exactly what we're not supposed to do with patients who you're worried about their mental status and give them tons of sedatives and they get better. I love the just counterintuitiveness of emergency medicine
and
sometimes.
Excessive amounts of sedatives too.
Excessive amounts, like an obstetrician pushing magnesium. I mean, just tons of sedatives. So we're going to talk about alcohol withdrawal, and it's a hot topic in emergency medicine right now because there are some new papers, new things made old, and I've definitely seen a difference in some of the patients that I've treated because all of a sudden we're going back to some of this old literature. So we've got Chris and Brian today. Hey, guys.
Hello, Aaron.
Hi.
So let's start by talking about the recognition. So a patient comes in, they're in a random bed, and you walk in to see them, and they're talking to you maybe a little incoherently. You can't quite tell, are they drunk? Are they withdrawing? Are they having some kind of psychotic break? Or is this something else medical going on?
Just the fact that you brought up either there's too much alcohol on board or there's an absence of alcohol on board and you can't tell the difference clinically, just that blows my mind, and I love it. And it actually bothers our consultants a lot, especially when we're talking about an admission and the patient already has an alcohol level of like 200, and you're saying, I'm bringing them in for withdrawal, and I've given them a ton of benzos. And we're in a unique situation in emergency medicine to see the acute presentation of these alcohol withdrawal patients that I think a lot of our consultants and subspecialists don't see, and they take that for granted. So it's one of the few disease processes that it's either too much or not enough of the chemical, and they present fairly similarly.
So quick poll, highest blood alcohol you've ever seen?
777.
Wow,
so jackpot.
Yep. 550 to 600, I think.
603, and I honestly could not tell that the lady was drunk. She was putting on her clothes, putting on makeup, and about to walk out the door, and we got the blood alcohol back. I go, hon, you can't leave.
I've amassed some papers actually documenting the highest blood alcohol levels, and some of them have been over 1,200. Patients have still been ambulatory with a narrow-based gait, non-wobbly, slurring speech, and clinically intoxicated, but very ambulatory. And one of them, the doctor repeated the alcohol level 3 times. They didn't believe it. And these go back all the way back to the 80s, where people have been documenting levels this high.
I have to feel that the patient was just pouring the liquor directly into the vacutainer.
Yeah.
They just hooked it up to the vodka bottle instead of to the patient.
But we know this is true. And everyone has a story, right? But there's a case that I had about a year ago where this patient came into South Campus, and one of our frequent flyers, we know this person fairly well, often comes in drunk. Well, guess what? He came in via EMS, just gorked out of his mind, smelled like booze, disheveled. They put him in the back hallway. Resident presents the patient. They said, I don't want to get a blood alcohol level. Her patient's drunk. We'll just metabolize to freedom. Go back and check on the patient. He felt hot. So check his temperature again. He's febrile. Well, that's kind of weird. I'd start talking to him or trying to talk to him. He won't really answer questions, but he's not shaky, he's not tachycardic, and he's not hypertensive. So I said, okay, we'll let it ride. And as I'm walking away from the patient, he starts seizing. So around that time, I sit down, and we've moved him over to a medical spot. They've already drawn blood. And wouldn't you know, his blood alcohol level, 10. This patient's withdrawing, and his first presenting symptom was seizure. And it turns out when he had shown up to the emergency department, he wasn't drunk, he was post-ictal. And then his next symptom was fever, and it was only after the fever that he started to mount tachycardia and hypertension. And then later when he woke up a bit more, then he showed you this tremor.
It's definitely on a spectrum, and it's like most things we see on a spectrum, you don't know where you're at. If it's hyperkalemia and you get the EKG, are you going to get the peak T waves? Are you going to get the wide QRS? Or are you just going to get the sine wave and go, what on earth is this? With alcohol withdrawal, you might come in and you see the patient who says, Doc, I haven't had anything to drink and I'm getting the shakes. And he's trembling a little bit and he's tachycardic and he's hypertensive. You might get the patient that's progressed on and now he's confused and he's showing signs of delirium. Or you might get the patient that comes in just seizing. And lastly, you get the patient that has been outside and is completely withdrawn and is hypothermic from exposure. Like happened to, unfortunately, one of our favorite frequent flyers who we all miss very much. So in finding this spectrum, I think it's easy to go in and see a patient that you've seen dozens of times before, like Chris said, and find that they're drunk. But I have been burned similarly. I've had a patient that I went in, the guy smelled like alcohol, and he wasn't really saying much to me, so I said, well, fine, let's just kind of let it ride. And then we decided to check an alcohol anyway because we were going to sign him out, and it was nothing. It was undetected, and he had a giant brain bleed because it turns out he actually got hit by a car. Mm-hmm. So I think in recognition, you have to recognize when a patient is intoxicated, and when a patient's intoxication has caused them to do all manner of craziness that they don't remember in order to cause some kind of illness, some kind of trauma, some kind of sepsis. So within that, have a high suspicion that, yeah, you might just be drunk again. But if you're not in my face yelling at me or trying to tell me a dirty joke or trying to give me a big sloppy kiss, then, you know, maybe you're not just drunk. So for me, I don't poke everybody who comes in with alcohol, but I will if I can't get them to answer my questions and sit upright. Those are my two
any
tests.
Any ambiguity at all. I'm a fan of blood alcohol levels, and part of that is because I don't feel married to the number. I base my disposition on clinical sobriety, not the number. I know some other attendings don't practice that way, and so getting a level for them is a double-edged sword. I don't feel that, and so for me, that's information that is only beneficial to me, never harmful.
Yeah, I agree. I think when the patient's talking to you is a totally different presentation than the undifferentiated, altered patient or someone who you can't get a history from, and that's just a different approach. So like you said, if they're admitting to drinking and you know this person's a drunk, whether you get a level or not, and I don't always get a level, sometimes I do. I agree with Chris. I'm not tied to that level. I think you have to be able to let someone go, and I think we'll get to this a little bit later too, but it's the ones that you don't get the information from the patient, they're not telling you anything, those are the ones I'll more likely get a level on and more likely look for other things. Maybe it is that head bleed, maybe it is sepsis, maybe they are postictal. And so looking for things when they can't talk to you.
So what are some things on physical exam that you guys find you kind of cling to differentiate, you know, is this withdrawal or not? I know we mentioned a couple of the autonomic things like tachycardia and hypertension, but what else?
Now, before us doctors chime in with all of our medical book learning and such, I thought it would be important to ask someone who has clearly been through alcohol withdrawal personally, Mr. Nathaniel Rathbone and the Night Sweats.
My heart is breaking, hands are shaking, lungs are calling on the name. My heart is breaking, hands are shaking, lungs are calling on the name.
Someone get that man a drink. You know, I'll be honest, tachycardia is my biggest thing that I hone in on. And not tachy to like 98 or 105, but tachy to 130, 140, profound tachycardia. I look at it on the monitor and go, huh, what's wrong with that guy? And walk over and assess the patient. And if I can't get their tachycardia under control, that makes me very concerned.
Yeah, I'm a tachycardia blood pressure, and those are really for the sick alcohol withdrawal ones. Those are the ones I actually watch those numbers change, and that determines my treatment. And so if someone has just a little shaking, but their heart rate and blood pressure look okay, I'm not going to aggressively treat them for withdrawal. I may give them a single oral or IV dose, but I'm not looking for high dose benzos or phenobarb in those patients. So I use those numbers more than anything. I think more than just I have a shake, or if they have hallucinations, that's a totally different ball game.
Sure.
But more than a tremor, I don't feel good. If they say, like, I'm not feeling well, I think I'm withdrawing, I'll look at their numbers and then base it based on those numbers how aggressive I'm going to get.
Yeah. And I find alcohol withdrawal, it's not something people always will come in and tell you. I mean, they might be there because they turned their ankle. They might be there because they've got belly pain from their alcoholic gastritis. But they look like as Terry Valenzuela would call him, a citizen. Mm-hmm. They look like someone who is just your average person, and it's got a stigma attached to it, of course, and you have to address it in a manner that allows you to get information from the patient. So whenever I see a tremor, I ask, hey, how long have you had that tremor for? Oh, you know, I get it from time to time. Really? So when do you happen to get it? And I press a little further versus, oh yeah, my neurologist is giving me beta blockers to try to help my tremor. Okay, that's not as big of a deal for me.
Yeah. And I do find that asking the patients if they think they're in withdrawal actually goes a long way. Now, sometimes people play us for benzos, and you got to have your radar on. In addition to that, I put a fair amount of stock, not all of my stock, but a fair amount into tongue fasciculations. That's really hard to fake. A lot of people don't even know that they're supposed to be faking that if they are. And I find that that will often pop up even before the hand tremors and stuff. So in addition to the autonomics, which I really follow those probably more than the rest of the physical exam, but on the exam, I put some stock in that. A couple of shifts ago, we had a guy who came in. He was signed out to me, and kind of ambiguous what was even going on. He was altered, but not horribly altered. He would carry on a conversation with you and do a pretty good job, I think, of in hindsight, faking it. But he was getting more and more altered throughout the course of that shift during sign out. And when I went and checked on him, he thought it was 1977, and he was acting really goofy. He was also febrile and had been febrile the whole time, and they were treating it as alcohol withdrawal. And my experience is, if you're aggressively treating alcohol withdrawal and they have a fever and you don't give Tylenol or ibuprofen, their fever goes down if you're treating withdrawal. And so that's, for me, something that, you know, if it's sepsis, that shouldn't happen. Well, we were giving him benzos and his fever wasn't going down. In fact, it was going up. He was getting more and more altered. We ended up having to tap him. And and he did not have tongue fasciculations. And so after a while, I kind of took a step back and said, you know, maybe this isn't withdrawal.
Yeah, it's good to reassess when you've done your initial interventions and it's not helping. All right, what else could be going on? So let's say you get the patient like Chris had, who came in and they did have a known history of alcoholism, and you turn your back on them and now they start seizing. So we want to move on now to resuscitation. So how do you start to resuscitate these patients? You see a seizure in front of you, and it's pretty much always seizure benzos. It's one word, right? Seizure benzos. Benzos, as I've heard them described, are God's gift to toxicologists and those who treat toxicologic problems. So benzos are a great treatment for pretty much any kind of seizure, whether it's alcohol withdrawal seizure, whether it's epileptic seizure, whether it's pseudo seizures. Benzos help them all. And so benzos are usually my first line that I'll grab. And that's for not just this, but for just your garden variety alcohol withdrawal. Doc, I'm feeling a little shaky. How do you guys approach? Maybe we'll start with the simple ones and then the seizures.
If it's, you're saying it's simple, straight up. So if someone just is saying I have a little withdrawal, if their numbers are okay, I will either start with an oral diazepam, maybe 5 or 10 milligrams. Hey, we just don't want you to withdraw. Here's something to go. If their numbers are starting to be off, maybe they're a little tachycardic in the 110s, maybe 150 over 90, they're probably going to get 10 of Valium IV from me. And then, I will escalate that as I need to based on their numbers and repeat it. And I think the key with, if the sicker they are, you're going to have to do a 15-minute reassessment. And I think you should give another drug in 15 minutes if your first one hasn't made a difference. And then if they're straight seizing, they're going to get 10, and I'll probably be at the bedside calling for 20 of diazepam right at that time, and then probably calling the pharmacy to say, how much diazepam do you have, and what other drugs can you get me fast?
Quick poll. What's the most amount of diazepam or benzos you've given a patient?
Cumulative or at once?
In one shot.
In one shot, 40. 40.
I've given 40 at
once. I've given 60.
Yeah, and 110 total.
And what's amazing about that, but I've only done it once.
I've hit 280.
280 total?
Cumulative, yeah.
That's, all right, so that's more than me. So what's amazing about this, though, you hit them with 60 in one shot. You hit them with a total of 280 milligrams of Valium, which in a normal person would have killed them at least four times over, okay? And they don't stop breathing.
That's right. So that blows everyone's mind. This is an amazing case. The worst withdrawal patient I've ever had. He actually came in as a trauma. So he was altered. And he was febrile later. Guy came in as a trauma because he was, quote unquote, assaulted. Well, it turns out no one saw the assault. He just had, he was in the park and someone assumed that he was hit over the head. Guy seized, fell down. Well, we didn't know that at the outset. So the guy came as a trauma. We worked him up and he just kept getting more and more altered. So we, in hindsight, we're looking back, we're like, well, this guy's temp's been going up and up and now he's finally reached that threshold of fever. I said, this doesn't make sense. So either he's septic or he's withdrawn. And then by that point, we had gotten some collateral information. Turns out the guy's a pretty heavy drinker. So then we realized, and we're playing catch up at this point, which is probably one of the big take-home points we want to teach people is don't get in the situation where you're having to play catch up. This is like the classic sign-out patient, right, where you're playing catch up. So I was aggressive with this. This is the guy I gave 40 to. I actually gave him 40 twice. So we had stepped up to that. You know, I went 20, 20, 40, 40. He had, before he got any Valium from me, he was getting Ativan from the resident. So he had already received, I think, 8 of Ativan. He ended up maxing out at 280 of Valium from me. He also got a little Versed popped in there when he was actually seizing. Versed's still what I go with actively seizing patients. He seized in the scanner, came back. I ended up giving this guy, in addition to all of that, a gram of Phenobarb. And his withdrawal slowed down, but he was getting so altered and wasn't protecting his airway, we intubated him. And after a gram of Phenobarb, 280 of Valium, 10 or 8 of Ativan, and a little bit of Versed, he was still requiring 60 mics per kg of propofol and opening his eyes and looking around. I literally was unable to fully sedate this guy. Now, he was adequately sedated, I think, from a withdrawal standpoint, but for an intubated patient to be doing what he was doing blew my mind.
So alcohol and benzos, they work the same. I mean, they help facilitate your GABA release, and when you don't have one of those on board, your ability, one of the few things I remember from toxicology, is GABA is an inhibitory neuron. So if you don't have inhibition, your body does crazy things. So we help them by providing all the stuff that they used to get, and who knows how much that guy was drinking on the outside. But that is, it's just striking how much you can give these patients.
But that goes to show, actually, that there actually are two receptors, two processes that are being affected. It's not just GABA. So alcohol suppresses GABA. And downregulates your GABA receptors because it's always hitting them, and it causes upregulation of your glutamate receptors. Well, the benzo only treats the GABA side of it, and so that's why you occasionally have patients that are refractory to benzos, because you're only hitting saturating those GABA receptors, but those glutamate receptors are still going full bore. And that's why there's other drugs that hit both receptors, like phenobarb, which we'll talk about in a bit, that I think in those are the cases where you need something to help suppress that. So maybe there's a role for ketamine in the future, maybe. But
there's nothing ketamine won't do.
That's true. But phenobarb for now, and we know that from, you know, old time studies too.
So it's funny in looking at all of these in all the literature and prepping for this, we've used lots of medications in order to try to treat alcohol withdrawal, and it's funny because depending on which specialty you are, you use a different kind of medication that's kind of akin to your specialty. So a lot of the neurology literature uses anticonvulsants, and some of the internal medicine literature uses gabapentin, and some of the critical care literature uses dexmedetomidate, and some of the trauma literature just uses IV alcohol. I mean, it's just great. It's so perfectly stereotypical. And as Chris said, some of the emergency medicine literature uses drugs that actually work.
That's right. What's old is new again.
You know what I would like to see is an emergency department study on the use of kombucha for the treatment of alcohol withdrawal seizures. That completes the stereotype.
That does complete the stereotype.
Yeah, I think to simplify this, right, I think there's three drugs you can use. One, Valium, diazepam.
Yeah.
Two, phenobarb. And three, if you're sending someone home, Olibrium or chlorodiazepoxide.
Totally. Completely.
That's
agree.
It. I mean, this is not a complex thing. And like Aaron and Chris are saying, this is accelerator and depressants, right? Alcohol is a depressant. GABA is a depressant, right? And glutamate is an excitatory. So it's just a balance of uppers and downers. And you're using medicines to see if they're up or down and get them to that nice, happy spot.
And if you get a patient that gets to the point where Chris had, and I had one as well, that we had to intubate for alcohol withdrawal, propofol also is a very potent GABA agonist. So so that will help as well. So four drugs, okay? Benzos, phenobarbital, chlordiazepoxide, something like that.
Which is also benzo. Yeah.
And propofol. Yeah. So the hot thing right now is to use phenobarbital, which is funny because that was also the hot thing 30 years ago. The 80s. It's so retro to use phenobarbital. All the cool docs with their stocking hats and their thick glasses are using phenobarbital. So we're going to start bloodletting again, too.
Well, phenobarbital, some of the studies came out in the 60s, and then most of them in the 80s. And there were some institutions around the country that started implementing that. I know in California, Pittsburgh was another place. Most of them were just going by the vials. And since the standard vial comes in 130, they were giving it in 130 increments. And there was kind of the major approach was to titrate up. So the one thing you have to remember about phenobarb, as opposed to diazepam onset of action, you're looking like 5 to 10 minutes. It's max. Phenobarb, technically 20 to 30 minutes. And so you don't have that that fast onset, and so you still have to worry a little bit about stacking your doses. And what most people would do is give 130, 260, or up from there as an initial dose, and then quickly, within probably 15 minutes, get a feel for whether these were having the effect you wanted, and then titrate up in increments of 130. And that's you'll still see that done now. However, given that its onset of action is a little bit delayed, and we don't want to stack our doses where you have an effect that hasn't reached its peak before you're giving an additional dose, people thinking, well, wouldn't it be better to give maybe a weight-based bolus loading dose up front that you are pretty confident is going to get you where you want to be, and then either use diazepam as your titrating dose in addition to that phenobarb, or even using more phenobarb in a smaller quantity. And so those are the two options that have been presented, and those who have listened to me talk on this know that I've referenced a blog, PulmCrit, where they have two separate postings on this algorithm, and if you want to go through it, that's fine. But the bottom line is that they recommend 10 milligrams per kilogram as a loading dose of phenobarb. And those who have practiced with me know that I don't always use 10 milligrams per kilogram. But if there's a patient who's withdrawing bad enough that I'm pretty confident they're going to require admission, that's my go-to dose. Okay, so it's not all comers. I don't give this loading dose to every patient. It's interesting when you look at the serum concentrations of a 10 milligram per kilogram loading dose in patients, and this has been well studied, none of them reach a level that is associated with over-sedation. But sometimes it does get you a little bit more sedated than you were shooting for, and that'll make us feel bad because it slows down our dispositions a little bit. And so 10 milligrams per kilogram, keeping in mind that still may not be enough, but for most people it is. And then you reassess after half an hour, and if they need a little bit more push, I put the phenobarb aside, and I switch to diazepam, and I give typically at that point they're doing well enough that just a little bit of oral is all they need. IV's fine. And according to the Pulm Care website, if you're still not getting where you want to be, don't keep sticking with the diazepam. Go back to the phenobarb and just give little 130 vials until you get where you want to be. And the two drugs potentiate and synergize a bit. So one, the diazepam increases the frequency of the GABA opening, and then the phenobarb just keeps it open longer. But keep in mind, the phenobarb is also suppressing those glutamate receptors, so it really slows down the excitation. And I think the problem that we had for a while when phenobarb went out of favor, it's when people started using more and more of those benzos. And then they're like, oh yeah, well, phenobarb worked. I guess this patient's refractory to benzos, so I'm going to go give my old usual dose of phenobarb. That's when you run into apnea. So patients who have been getting benzo, 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 and then you give them a whopping dose of phenobarb, you're grabbing your ET tube at the same time. If you do it the other way, where you're giving them a high dose of phenobarb up front, then you can titrate your diazepam to a more comfortable level without having to overshoot. And I've been doing this really consistently for about 2 years now, and I have yet to have a single episode of respiratory depression.
I think that, right, people are worried about barbs because all we're taught in med school and residency is barbiturate coma. Those two things go together. So the thought is, anytime I use a barbiturate, I'm going to put someone in a coma. Where barbiturates have been used for a really long time, and they don't put everyone in a coma.
That's right. And there's not a neurologic condition that phenobarb can't fix.
Well, and Chris, will you use a 10 milligram dose per kg in every patient? Or there's, right, because we talked to this as a spectrum. Yeah. So you say you kind of titrate it. You individualize it.
I do. So
based on how
really,
sick or
really
not sick.
Really gestalt it. But if they're really, if they're looking bad, always 10 mgs per kg without batting an eye. But sometimes I have people that come in that, like, you know, they're doing okay. I'll do 5 mgs per kg, and it's just a random number that I pulled out. But for me, it's worked great. So I'll do 5 mgs. Sometimes I'll do 6. You
know? It's half. I mean, what I was taught by one of our toxicologists who's gone on to bigger and better things in Texas, Dr. Spencer Green. If you're listening, I don't know how you got this. I'm glad you're listening. So he told me, well, give some diazepam, and if that doesn't work, then give another dose. And if that doesn't work, then double it. And if that doesn't work, then double it. And if that doesn't work, then double it. And I was like, we're talking some serious benzos. Same with the phenobarb. You know, it's like, why are you giving 5 instead of 10? I don't know. It's half, and you can always give a little bit more if you need to. So we talked about treatment. If we get people out of withdrawal, then that's great. You know, we get some of these patients out of withdrawal, and then often what we'll do is put them on the CWAS scores, which is the Clinical Institute Withdrawal Assessment for Alcohol Scale. Way to go, Brian. And this was described to me as an alcohol drip, basically. So this is alcohol withdrawal drip. So you get a patient that you've sedated, and you get them bolused with their sedative when they're intubated, and then you start a drip to keep them sedated. But if you just start those patients off on a drip, they come flying off and off the table trying to grab at their tube. This is very similar. You get a bolus. You get your phenobarb or your benzodiazepine. medications or whatever you're going to use to get the patient out of withdrawal. And the idea behind CEWA is that it will keep you out of withdrawal. And for anyone that's not familiar with it, you must not have worked at the VA yet. But this is, it's clinical, it's historical, what the patient says, and it's also a little bit of your exam as well. But it's basically a function of do you have nausea and vomiting? Do you have tremor? Are you sweaty? Do you feel anxious? Do you feel agitated, which is not the same as anxious? Are they having any like tactile disturbances where they're feeling bugs crawling on them? And do they have any auditory disturbances where they're having hallucinations, visual hallucinations, and headache and orientation? That's kind of all together, and you get scores depending on how badly your alcohol withdrawal is affecting those individual parts. And these scores, one score by itself, it doesn't necessarily mean much. It's the score in series, and usually CEWA scores are done every 2 to 4 hours. And when the nurse goes in and does these scores and document them, if it starts at 28, and then the next one after you've treated them, it's going down, and it's 24, and then it's 18, and okay, that's good. If it starts at 2, and then it goes to 8, and then it goes to 15, you are going back into withdrawal, and you need to get back on top of it with more bolus doses, more benzodiazepines, more phenobarb, whatever you need to keep them out of withdrawal because they're slipping out, and the CEWA by itself is not doing it. Depending on your score, you get a certain amount of either Librium or Ativan with a max, I think, of 4 at a single intervention. So what happens, and this is often the sign-out patient, the night-to-day patient. This patient came in last night, and they were drunk, and we're just waiting for them to sober up and go home. And then when you go in to check on them, they're in florid withdrawal. And you see that either the CEWA wasn't ordered, or it was ordered, and it was slowly creeping up, but we didn't know where to see it, where to find the scores in the EMR. So
it's the perfect storm, because you've got nurses that are on their way out of the department, physicians that are on their way out of the department. You also have CEWA scores that are different because they have different people assessing them. Patients are tired, so they're sleeping, and their withdrawal is creeping up, and nurse doesn't want to wake them up and ask them if they're agitated. Meanwhile, their tachycardia is getting worse, and they're getting more hypertensive and sweaty.
I think that with CEWA, I'm not a super fan that I don't feel I use it as much, partly because I think it's misused. I think people see a patient and, oh, they have alcohol on board, I'll put them on CEWA. No. They have alcohol on board, you need to assess them for withdrawals yourself and treat those withdrawals initially, because this is where people fall behind. They're just like, oh, I'll put them on CEWA and I'll see if they withdraw. I think what you want to know is, are they starting to show signs of withdrawal, or when do I think they're going to withdraw if they are a chronic drinker based on their clinical exam and how they're looking? So you want to be ahead of the curve, like Aaron's saying, you need to give your boluses and then have them on CEWA. Don't just put them on CEWA and rely on that as your sole indicator of whether the patient is improving or not improving. I might take is I try to peek in on them at least every 2 hours is my clinical practice.
And often these patients aren't on the monitor. They're in the hallway, right? And, depending on where you work, sometimes there's several people in the hallway or in the room where they're just kind of waiting to sober. And that's an easy place for a patient to slip through the cracks.
Yeah, when a resident tells me that they're putting a patient on CEWA, my next question is always, so they're not in withdrawal now, is what you're saying. And so if they say no, they're not in withdrawal now, then I say okay. And then second part, is there an order in there for the nurse to call you if their scores start going up? And if you ask them, do you know where you can find the scores in the chart? The answer is always no. So how are they going to know? So if there's an order for the nurse to call them if the scores start going up, and frankly, it just comes down to how good your nurses are, how much you trust them. And, you know, oftentimes it's simply just a matter of looking the nurse in the eye and saying, please let me know if this patient starts getting more, showing evidence of withdrawal, and I'll start treating them aggressively.
And I'll usually, if I've got a patient that's just waiting to sober, if I got a blood alcohol level, I have some idea of maybe when they're going to get to normal. Mm-hmm. But I will put every patient that, on CEWA if I'm about to sign them out, especially because now I have an idea of what this patient looked like when they came in, but the attending I'm signing out to does not know what this patient used to look like. So that's a very different perspective. And then I tried to look for any literature on how do you predict who's at high risk of withdrawal. I think it makes sense. People that have been in withdrawal before, one of the questions I always ask, do you shake when you stop drinking? Yeah. Have you had DTs before? Yeah. Then let's try to prevent it. There was one great study that showed that you can actually assess for these patients their higher risk if they have low platelets, high homocysteine levels, and low pyridoxine levels.
Well, that's good because I always check that.
Yeah, we're going to try to petition Banner to bring back our point of care homocysteine levels. But in reality, this has more to do with reassessing your patient, which is one of the things that always makes a lot of ER docs cringe of like, I saw them already. I have to see them again? Yes, the longer they're there, you have to see your patient. It shouldn't just be something the nurse goes in and checks on. So I have a question then. If we're trying to prevent these patients from going into withdrawal, then we can medicate them. We can just kind of have them hang out and try to treat their withdrawal. Or sometimes patients don't want to sober up, which is a choice that when they're sober, they're allowed to make. It's kind of a tough thing. If we don't want anybody to continue with such a debilitating disease as alcoholism, but it is their choice if they want to. So Brian made the comment that he asks, what do you say?
I just ask, are you going to stop drinking today, or when I let you go, are you going to go drink? And if they say they're going to go drink, I try to get them out of the department as fast as possible. Mm-hmm. If they're saying, yeah, I want to quit today, or I'm not going to drink anymore, then we have a discussion about getting you to a detox center or trying some benzos on board to go home to prevent withdrawal symptoms and prevent you from having to come back to the ER.
I do the same thing.
So with these patients, if we have a blood alcohol level, if we don't, how do you determine clinically sober versus serum sober? And does it matter? Because we're told to hold on to these patients for a long time sometimes. I can't do whatever until they're sober. Well, some of these patients, as we mentioned before, when they get down to blood alcohol levels of 200, that is low for them. So they can't tolerate it. They start going into withdrawal. So are we actually harming people by letting them go while they're still, serum intoxicated? Or are we harming people by making them hang out until they go into clinical withdrawal?
I would argue there's no such thing as serum intoxicated. There's clinical intoxication.
And legal intoxication.
Legally, the case is all side on the physician's side, as long as they've documented a good quote unquote road test. There was a famous case fairly recently in New York City where this was the exact situation that we always say we're afraid of. Patient walks outside of the emergency department, gets hit by a bus. Literally, that happened. Physicians sued.
They should really reroute the bus lines.
No buses should go by a hospital.
No.
So, but anyway, they documented a really good exam, and it didn't really matter what the level was, and they could also argue the patient went out and got drunk.
So even without knowing that we were doing this for the podcast this month, this became a really hot topic just last week with many of our attendings and residents here at the University of Arizona. A high court in New York City recently ruled that emergency doctors have no duty to hold an intoxicated person and that this could violate their free will. Determination seems to be made on whether or not the patient is in control of his or her faculties, and the patient in question was able to walk under his own power and carry on a conversation. Our conversation amongst the faculty and residents had a couple of points that I wanted to acknowledge for the podcast. Number one, the legal limit refers to the blood alcohol level at which you are unable to operate a motorized vehicle. This has nothing to do with whether or not you have the capacity to make your own decisions, stupid though they may be. Number two, It is your duty to prevent the patient from knowingly harming themselves, and we don't take violating a constitutional right lightly. There was case law cited of patients being restrained as they were about to jump out of an open window because they were delusional. But the patient in this case did not have any delusions and was able to walk under his own power. Capacity and sobriety are both clinical decisions that are made by the physician. And number three, if I am ever sued for letting an intoxicated patient leave early, I'm going to use this line by our own Terry Valenzuela, which goes, "Your Honor, it is true that I kept this man in the emergency department against his will. Nothing makes me happier than to see him here, well and able to sue me. At that time that we were both in the emergency department, I feared that he would not survive to do so."
What I tell residents is they need to document not just patient was road tested adequately and discharged. You need to explain what that road test is for you and for everyone that's something else. I use what actually Bernie taught me. Patient is ambulating with a narrow-based gait, no truncal ataxia, ANO times 4, no slurred speech. And if you can document that, I feel like it's pretty solid.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think I try to get these people out as fast as possible.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to sit on someone who's intoxicated. The ones I hold on to are, okay, there's a trauma concern, I got to do serial reassessments, or there's something else going on. But if they're just there for alcohol, I try to get them out. And I think of this as back in college, right? There's a lot of people drunk at parties. What do you try to do? You try to get them to their bed. That's where you're trying to get them. And my bed in the ER is not the same as their bed.
Now,
Their bed, right? Not my bed.
That's right.
Now, cardboard box, and it's a cold night.
Wait, in college, you're not your bed?
Oh, no. My bed? Oh, not my bed. No. Get him to someone else's bed. My bed, then I'm in. We got a whole other legal thing going on, so I want him to someone else's bed. But that was the goal. You get your drunk buddy into their bed, face down with a little bucket, so when they vomit, it goes off the side of the bed. And that's where you want. I want to get these people to the same place, but I want them to be safe, right?
Yeah. You know, a great person to talk to about this is Peter Rosen. And this is shocking. He's actually kind of opinionated on this. And he brings up, he references all the drunk takes that used to exist. You see fewer and fewer of them now. Patients would go into withdrawal there. They would have their withdrawal there. They didn't have people like, you know, dying and all the time in these drunk takes. He argues that we worry too much about the withdrawal and making sure that someone is completely sober before we let them go.
Okay, so before you say anything, I did not just turkey Peter Rosen. I did turkey something Peter Rosen may have said or that may have been misquoted, and I'll ask him about it for the next podcast. But legitimately, there are deaths from alcohol withdrawal. It is one of the more serious physiologic withdrawals and is something that you should be concerned with.
Sobriety, I think, is a spectrum. It's not something that you just arrive at. It's like it's not a binary thing. It's a spectrum. And so as long as they are able to ambulate in a way that they're not going to fall down, they're able to cognate a way that they're not making horrible decisions, that's really all you have to ask. The rest is on them.
Yeah, I agree with Chris. I think I ask them to feed them. I want to see them eat and drink, not aspirate. And I want them to walk after they get some food in them because their glycogen stores are going to be down. And so I'd like to get a little glucose on board. And then if they've eaten something, they may not drink immediately right away, but maybe they're going to start walking. I think documenting that nice exam is a good way. I just want to see them walk a straight line. I completely agree. And then they're able to go. Or someone can pick them up.
Will you tell Sam Kimes' story?
Yeah. So I just heard this from Sam last shift. And so, but it was a county setting. And so he's an intern. He asked one of his residents, "So how do I treat alcohol withdrawal?" The resident was pissed, looked at him like some poor dog and said, "Come here, go get me a Dixie cup." So he goes and gets a Dixie cup for this resident. resident, hands it to him. The resident fills it halfway with water, and he says, you take this Dixie cup of water and you hand it to your patient, and if they shake and no water comes out, they get 130 of phenobarbital. And if they shake and some of the water spills out, you give them 260 of phenobarbital. And if they shake and all the water comes out and they can't hold the cup, 520 of phenobarbital. That's all you have to do for alcohol withdrawal. Okay, cool.
We can stop the podcast right there. But I feel like, you know, these are big doses. And I think maybe phenobarbital might be easier to get past people because we don't, up until recently, we haven't been using it as much. So nobody knows the dose per se. But it's something about in your mind that it's tough. It was tough for me to give those doses. It's tough for residents sometimes to see going that big. The guy I had that I gave 60 to, this was over, he came in very confused and then had what seemed to be seizures, but I really, it was strange because he was never quite post-ictal. He was just posturing and doing this weird tremor, and it was homecoming weekend, and maybe it was just a bias from seeing four other people come in alcohol withdrawal, but I was like, he's in alcohol withdrawal. So what we got ready for is intubation in case he stops breathing, and ended up giving him about 80 milligrams of diazepam, and he never stopped breathing. So we said, well, there you go. It must be alcohol withdrawal. But those doses are insane.
I think we fear the unknown, right? So if I don't know that I can give that or I've never seen it happen, I'm going to be afraid of it. So I think with this is when you are going to start to give someone these doses, bring other people. Come here. Everyone come here. Let's watch this.
Yes.
Here is 10 milligrams of Valium. Here is 20. Here is 40. What happened? Right? Now that you've experienced it, it's less, you're less afraid of this because you've experienced this dose.
And I think the people that you really have the hardest time convincing are the pharmacists. Not our clinical ED pharmacists, but the one downstairs has to send up my bag of 1 gram of phenobarb, and invariably we'll get a phone call. What's the indication? My indication is I ordered it, but
so mouthy.
The other indication is alcohol withdrawal. Well, this is really a dose we should be giving to like actively seizing patients. Okay, he's actively seizing.
Great, we can wait 10 minutes then.
Yeah, no, so it's taken a little bit of push, and luckily, thankfully, our clinical pharmacists have done a really good job educating the people downstairs, but I want them to come upstairs sometimes. I want them to see this and see the massive doses that we're giving and get them comfortable with it.
So we'll get to disposition. So we got some patients that can go home, and these patients have to be clinically sober, not showing any signs of withdrawal. For me, that means that they are not tachycardic, they're not tremulous, they are walking with a narrow-based gait without truncal ataxia, not slurring their speech, and ANO times 4. I mean, that's great. These patients can go home, and I agree with Brian that I do ask them, I go, do you want help with your alcoholism? And if they say yes, I usually give them enough to get them to whatever our detox center is. For patients that are not doing that, I can't get them to stop being tachycardic. I can't get them to stop being tremulous. I admit these patients. And I think that one of the difficult parts is when they come in and you're calling the hospitalists who do a wonderful job where they're at, but they have the problem of not sick enough, needs to go home, too sick, needs to go to the ICU. Mm-hmm. I've been in that position on pediatrics. That's a tough place to be. How do you convince the hospitalist they're sick enough they need to be admitted, but not so sick that they need to go to the ICU?
CWAS scores have helped at that point. The quantity of benzos that I've given without adequately getting where we need to be, that goes a long way. So frankly, when I've called them and said I've given them 800 of phenobarb and some Valium, and they're still acting like they're in withdrawal, usually I've oversold it at that point, and they want the patient to go to the ICU.
Yeah, that's what I've done. I said, well, the patient's gotten 40 milligrams of diazepam total. Well, that's a lot. They probably need to go to the intensive care. No, because now they're talking and eating and not tachycardic, and like, you got to come see the patient first. But it scares people. And I'll tell some of the residents on the PED side, I go, you need to call this admission. Don't startle kill the hospitalist.
That's right. They spook easily.
Well, they do, because they're over the phone, and they don't know what they're getting. And, you know, oftentimes, especially depending on where you work, they're not in-house. But now they're taking your word over the phone that this patient is stable, so they have to trust you, and you have to earn that trust.
Well, I think I use numbers based on who I want to go to. So if I want them in the ICU, I will tell them the number of milligrams that I have given. Yeah. If I am wanting to go to the floor, I'll say, this patient was a little hypertensive, tachycardic, and I gave some benzos, and now they're doing great. Yeah. Their numbers are 120 over 70. They feel well. They're eating a sandwich. I'd like to get them observed. Huh. So I don't tell them the number, even though it's 130 total. But
how much did you give them? Enough.
Yeah, I just a couple doses.
I did have one case with Mike Hudson, so going way back in the time machine there.
Mighty Mike.
Mighty Mike. This is a patient who we really legitimately wanted admitted to the hospital for cardiac reasons. Guy was a long, long time drinker. Beer was his drug of choice. And he told us that he will maintain withdrawal with any medication we give him. And we weren't using phenobarb back in these days. I wasn't anyway. And we could give him all the benzos we wanted, but it wasn't going to do any good. And the only thing that would treat him was beer. So we said, well, we can't just put you on beer in the hospital. And so we gave him just inordinate amounts of benzos, and he really wasn't getting better. He was getting sedated, but maintaining his autonomic instability. And so that was really bothering me, because I said, well, eventually we're going to reach a point where he has to be intubated, and he's still having these problems. And so at that point, the family showed up and said, didn't he tell you that beer was the only answer for this? Well, yeah, he did, but we can't do that. And they said, why not? I said, I don't know why not. So I talked to Mike, and Mike said, yeah, you can drink beer. So we admitted him to the hospital, and we had the family go out and buy cases of beer and a cooler. And he went upstairs, admitted to the floor. I talked to the hospitalist beforehand and said, let this guy drink as much as he wants. It's the only way to get his alcohol withdrawal under control. And he did fine. Absolutely fine. Was great on the floor. Has never had a high score. So every once in a while, I guess ethanol still is the cure.
Even with his sodium of 102 from his beer potomania.
Well, that's with the VA. We would have beers with meals, I remember, and you would order them
the patient,
for all your drunk.
Patient, Brian.
No, I would have a beer with them at mealtime.
You don't want a doctor with shaky hands.
That's right. If I'm withdrawing, you're in worse trouble.
So do you guys have any pearls for how you document some of this stuff? I like what Chris said that Bernie told him about documenting how the patient looked when they left. Because having done a couple depositions now, not being the one sued, but being just the doctor caring for the case, I mean, really, you go, I don't remember this patient. What does my chart say? You are fully reliant on that chart you did 9 months to 5 years ago. I have no knowledge of this case except for what my chart says. That's what happens when it goes to trial or if it goes to deposition or anything else. So I think having that for a patient that goes home, very, very helpful. Anything else you guys would add?
I try to give a good picture of how they presented too. You know, I don't always think our HPI and physical exam really say what the patient looks like or how they were behaving, but to put it in plain English, you know, patient showed signs of alcohol poisoning. You know, they were unconscious and not responding. Versus, they were, you know, alcohol intoxicated with, you know, but answering questions, wanting to sleep, ambulated to the bathroom with help. You know, those kind of things. So they were just shaking and their blood pressure. You know, they're hypertensive, tachycardic, and they did not look well. They were sweating and uncomfortable. I mean, those go more, I think, than sometimes our physical exam and HPI.
Yeah, the less you test, the more you have to explain. And so that's another pearl, I would say. If you're not going to do a big workup on someone who's intoxicated with alcohol, you need to explain why.
Yeah, I think that the patients that you get signed out on, you know, these are ones that you have to go see versus the nurse says, hey, they want to go home. Okay, let me get their paperwork together. These are patients that you have to reassess. One of the things we'll talk about with documentation is, well, I couldn't get a good history. I didn't do a review of systems. I didn't get their family past social history. That's fine for your chart, but then you have to actually go back and get that stuff and document just the stuff that matters, you know. I'm a big believer that the review systems doesn't really matter. It's the appendix of the chart. So in looking at the patient after you've reassessed them, now you ask, are you having chest pain? Are you having trouble breathing? Are you having seizures? Anything else like that? With all those things documented later in your follow-up note or your medical decision making. And now I felt the patient was safe to go home.
I try to comment also on signs of trauma. I mean, I almost treat alcoholics when I see them like a trauma patient. I'm pushing over all their bones.
Correct.
And
absolutely.
Looking at their skin for abrasions. Maybe it's old abrasions. I comment on that versus a fresh abrasion. I think all of that is important, and it helps me decide what I'm going to do with this patient. If there's no signs of trauma and they're just drinking, that's a patient I'm already thinking I can get going home, as opposed to there's scrapes up and down the forehead and face, and you know, I need to do more on this patient because something happened. I mean, they didn't just, you know, drink the booze and all of a sudden their face fell off, you know.
Yeah, always remember that your alcoholics are always trauma patients. They're always coagulopathic. They often have vitamin deficiencies. And so yes, you treat the withdrawal. Please treat the withdrawal, but touch their joints and all their long bones and squeeze hard and make sure there's no evidence of trauma that they're not telling you about. And then when it comes time for a sobriety exam, if it's not adding up, remember things like Wernicke's encephalopathy. If you didn't scan them and they're not acting right, remember they're coagulopathic with overly aged brains, and so there's lots of slosh around in there and they break vessels and they can show up subacutely sometimes.
I think that once your patient is sobered up, they are a brand new patient and you start over from scratch with them. Well, thank you guys very much. We'll talk next time once the college students are back.
Hi, everyone. This is Casey Solem coming to you from Scottsdale, Arizona, with a little peer review. For those residents who don't know me, which I don't think most do now, I graduated 2014 from the university campus and moved up to the Phoenix area. I, for the first 2 years, worked for a group that covered four Phoenix area hospitals. They were all with Banner, one of which was Banner University Medical Center Phoenix, so kind of the sister to UMC in Tucson. And then there were three other community hospitals, one of which was single coverage. And at night, I was the only doctor in the building. I've subsequently moved to a new job now in Scottsdale, where I cover the three old Scottsdale hospitals, which are now part of Honor Health. That's Osborne, which is a level one trauma center, Shea, which is just a large community hospital, and then Thompson Peak, which is a relatively small community hospital. So between the two jobs, I've now worked seven different hospitals in the Phoenix area with a whole big variety of practice environments. So hopefully I've got a little bit of a broad perspective on this. So I think that these guys covered really most everything that there is to say. So rather than really trying to correct anything, what I'd like to spend the time doing is just cover some pearls that I remember from residency that I carry with me on each of my shifts when I'm approaching these kinds of patients, and hopefully these will help you when you see these patients yourself. So the first thing is, and I can't remember which attending it was, but somebody in residency told me, psychs and drunks are out to screw you. So just keep that in mind. I know that we all are looking for the quick dispo. We're all looking for the obvious answer that seems to make the most sense, but just be careful with these patients because they're patients we tend to want to find just a quick answer and move on. Oh, they must just be drunk. Oh, they must just, you know, they're crazy. But the reality is that bad things happen to these people too. And the truth is that when bad things happen to an alcoholic, they're more likely than not going to be drunk. So again, just make sure you don't do premature closure when it comes to making a decision on what's causing their symptoms. And then just remember too, and I know that Chris covered this a little bit, but drunk people have a tendency to have more significant trauma injuries, specifically head injuries, because they don't have many platelets, they don't have many clotting factors, they don't have much balance, they don't have very good judgment in general or insight, and then they have some atrophy, so they don't have big brains, which means that that their brain can slosh around inside of their head and lead them to higher risk of brain injuries from falls. So let's talk about recognition of alcohol withdrawal. You know, oftentimes this is really straightforward. Somebody comes in and says, "Doc, I think I'm withdrawing from alcohol. I normally drink, you know, 12 packs a day, and I didn't today." But sometimes it's a little bit more subtle. And just, you know, when you think about this, I think that alcohol withdrawal can be a little bit of a challenge to pick up in some cases. It tends to mimic some other common diseases, for example, altered mental status, fever, and tachycardia. Well, that sounds a lot like sepsis to me or meningitis, but remember, it can also be withdrawal. So don't quickly jump to either one of those conclusions, make sure you've really considered, could they be septic? Could this be meningitis? Or is this alcohol withdrawal when you're treating these kinds of patients? And remember that if you're not totally sure, there's probably not a whole lot of harm in drawing blood cultures and looking for sources of infection and maybe even giving a dose of broad-spectrum antibiotics until you get it all sorted out. So just keep that in mind. The second thing is that there's a distinction between fever and hyperthermia, that the thermometer can't tell you the difference, and really you're not going to be able to tell it very, very easily at the bedside. So again, hyperthermia could be because they passed out drunk outside in the Arizona heat, or because they took a co-ingestance of other like antipsychotic medications, things that tend to make you run hot, or of course it could still be sepsis. So again, just kind of keep that distinction in your mind. This isn't always super straightforward. I think that that there was a lot of good discussion about whether or not to draw alcohol levels on patients that you suspect to be drunk or suspect to be withdrawing. In my practice, I tend to do it if I'm looking to admit the patient. If I think I want to send the patient home and I think that they look clinically well enough to go home, then I totally agree with Chris Williams that a clinical sober exam that's well documented is much more effective than trying to draw a level and then say, oh, well, I think that this person has a high tolerance, so at this level they may not be intoxicated. Which leads me to a good point, though, to keep in mind that the number really doesn't have much value to you, because there are some alcoholics out there who can be completely clinically sober at 200 or 300, and there can be some people who are totally wasted at 80 or 100. We talked about what's the highest level anybody's seen. I can't say the highest number I've ever seen of alcohol level, but I can say that I've seen somebody in florid withdrawal at 393. So a high level doesn't mean you can't be withdrawing, and a low level doesn't mean that you can't be intoxicated. So just, again, keep that in mind. And then something we didn't talk about much, but I'd like to highlight is don't forget the basics. So don't forget to be checking sugars on these people. Think about thiamine deficiency, the other vitamin deficiencies that we commonly see with alcoholics, and electrolyte abnormalities. Last point I want to make about recognition is, I think this is a Frank Walter point that he used to make, but think about, why do they stop drinking? So if there's somebody who's an alcoholic who drinks every day, then that's what they're going to want to do. So ask them why. Why did you stop today? What was different about today? I remember a couple of cases that I had where they said, oh, well, I stopped because my belly really hurt, and thought, oh, well, gosh, let's investigate that. And it turned out they had a rip-roaring pancreatitis. So just keep in mind that there's potentially going to be a reason why they stop. So moving on to treatment, I totally agree with what everybody said, that benzodiazepines early and benzodiazepines often is really the mainstay of treatment. I think if you do know that this is alcohol withdrawal, it's definitely not a bad choice to start with something long-acting with active metabolites like Valium. But that's something I would consider, especially for the younger people who don't have a lot of experience yet. If you're not sure and you're not sure the dosing on Valium, if you haven't yet learned that, stick with the benzos that you know. And Ativan is a perfectly fine choice, at least to get things started. You can always go back and look up doses later, but I think that if you've got a really sick withdrawal patient in front of you, it's probably worth getting something on board that you know the dose to off the top of your head, 2 to 4 milligrams of Ativan, and then you can go look up the doses of Valium if you need to. I remember, from toxicology, I can't say that I was huge in toxicology, but I definitely thought it was interesting that the pathophysiology a little bit behind why barbiturates work better in some cases is kind of interesting. So benzodiazepines, when they work on the receptor level, they really only help to potentiate the action of the GABA hormone that you already have floating around in your brain. But if you're an alcoholic, you probably have down-regulated the amount of hormone that you have, which is why some people can be refractory to benzodiazepines. The benefit to barbiturates is that they don't require the actual GABA hormone to be working or even present. They can just activate the receptors on their own, which then in turn gives you the effect you're looking for of sedating and reducing their withdrawal symptoms. So it's just kind of interesting to know if you're curious about why barbiturates tend to work a little bit better. And then, the last thing that I want to point out is that in my practice, I'm really aggressive with these patients, really aggressive up front. And I think the reality is that if you don't treat alcohol withdrawal aggressively and appropriately, then you end up dealing with the common triad of toxicology deaths of seizure, coma, and death. But if you're too aggressive with benzos and you end up snowing them, or you get the side effects that we were talking about in the podcast of respiratory suppression and even apnea, well, then you intubate them. But we're fully capable of doing that. Every emergency doctor will be capable by the time you're done, with your residency, of intubating a patient. So I think, instead of focusing too much on, oh, what's the appropriate dose? And am I giving too much? Just give what it takes clinically to get them to the point you need them. And if you overshoot, well, then you overshoot and you intubate them. That's fully something that you and I can take care of. But it's much, much easier to intubate a patient you've overly aggressively treated than to try to continue to play catch up on somebody who's seizing in front of you. Which leads me to another thing that, you know, we talk about, oh, you're going to end up giving really high doses of benzos. And that's true. But the reality is that if the nurses start raising their eyebrows, or the people around you start raising their eyebrows saying, my gosh, that seems like a really big dose, we've already given them so much, just remind them and remind yourself that you got to look at the patient in front of you. And if you've given 80 milligrams of Valium and they still look tachycardic and hypertensive and they look like they've got a lot of psychomotor agitation, then you can probably, you know, convince yourself and convince the people around you that another dose isn't likely going to hurt them. It's not like you've cumulatively given a big dose and now these people are teetering on the edge of apnea. If they're still agitated, they're still agitated and they still need some more. And then I want to wrap up just by talking about CEWA. See, well, I totally agree with these guys that CEWA is not really what gets you to the point you want to be at. You really need to aggressively upfront treat them with benzos and get their withdrawal under control. You can then put the CEWA protocol on as a way to keep them from sliding backwards into withdrawal. But don't expect that you're going to be able to just write the CEWA order on your patients and everything's just going to magically get better. It really doesn't. A good benefit of CEWA is that it puts orders in the computer, especially at UMC where I remember the order sets. And it puts orders in the computer that requires frequent reassessments from nurses. It requires cardiac monitoring. It requires respiratory monitoring. And the nice thing about it is that once you put that order into effect, it really forces the staff, the nurses, the medics, the techs, to pay a much closer attention to the patient. So if you're concerned that a patient might end up going the wrong direction, the CEWA protocol is not a bad idea to get on board so that it keeps the staff's eyes really closely on that patient. And I think that really covers the majority of it. Just one last piece I just want to throw in there is that there was a lot of talk about dyspo and, you know, how do you decide whether or not these patients need to be admitted or discharged. You know, I think something that something just keep in mind is, I can say now, having worked in 7 hospitals out in the community, for the most part the community, there's not as much pushback on getting patients admitted at really any hospital that I've yet worked at as there was at UMC. So if you got somebody that you're concerned about, somebody that you think isn't necessarily safe to go home, understand that although at UMC you may struggle to get that patient admitted because the hospitalists, you know, all the issues that we talked about in the podcast, you probably will find when you get out in practice that that's a little bit exaggerated and it might be easier to get these patients admitted. So don't let that be a fear that you have, or don't let that be something that you think is going to, you know, negatively affect the way you treat your patients. If you feel uncomfortable and you want the patient obsed, you shouldn't find too much pressure to avoid that, at least in general out in the community. But again, you know, you may be in a place where you get totally different vibes than that, but it's just something to keep in mind. All right, I think that's it for now. Thank you guys so much for giving me the chance to give my input, and those of you who were around in my day, I miss you guys, and for everybody else, hopefully you're having as good an experience as I did. All right, take care.